Honourable members, good morning and welcome. I would like to advise that we open our meeting of the Portfolio Committee on International Relations. You're most welcome to our meeting. Let me also welcome the presenters from the Department of Defense and officials from the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. I see that we also have members of the media. Most welcome. There are two principal items in our agenda today. We are going to take a presentation from the Department of Justice. Following the decision of the High Court on withdrawal from the International Criminal Court. And the second one will be a presentation by the Department of Defense on the Foreign Service Bill, as usual. But let's get into item number two. And before that, on the occasion of his first attendance to our meeting, let me welcome Honorable Brian Molefe. Honorable Molefe, most welcome. We were advised that Honorable Molefe will serve in our committee as well as the Portfolio Committee on Economic Development. And most welcome. We look forward to benefiting from your huge intellectual capital, your experience, your input. You're most welcome to the committee, Honorable Molefe.
Thank you, sir.
And I have received two apologies, and I want to I want the secretary to speak to that. But they are here with me. I can speak right to them right away. We have a written apology from the acting minister of Justice, Honorable Faith Mutambi, who has not been here, who is not able to be here with us, and has deployed or assigned officials to come and make that presentation. There is a lady here, Ayesha Johar. It is properly pronounced. Yes, most welcome. The other apology is from the Minister of Defense. She's not able to be here with us, but she has assigned or deployed Brigadier General M. Sizani. Are you Sizani?
I am Brigadier General Sizani.
I'm just checking whether you are related to the former chief whip. No, don't say anything about that.
I'm not related to me.
Brigadier General T.M. Mkhakato. Yeah, thank you very much. Siyabonga, most welcome. We're happy to have you here. And with that, I don't think we need to introduce anybody. Honorable...
Just on the apologies, Honorable
Kalyan is attending the Pan-African Parliament meeting.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mkhalapa. With that, I think we can latch on. Over to you, Ms. Johar. Ms. Johar is the acting state law advisor in the Department of Justice. Yeah. Over to you.
Good morning, Chairperson, honourable members. I'm Ayesha Johar, and I'm
bring it nearer to you.
The acting chief state law advisor. I am joined by the deputy director general, Ms. Calais Pillay, from the Department of Justice, as well as Dr. Kobus Meyer, who is the state attorney, who assisted in the litigation of this matter, as well as Theo Hercules, who is the deputy chief state law advisor. Thank you. I've been.
We are four.
Yeah.
We must get all those names for our cause. Thank you.
Yes, Chair. I've been asked to provide a briefing to the Portfolio Committee on the recent judgment of the Democratic Alliance versus the Minister of International Relations and others. On the 19th of October 2016, the National Executive took a decision to withdraw from the Rome Statute. A notice of withdrawal was subsequently signed by the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation to give effect to that decision and deposited it with the Secretary General of the United Nations. This triggered the process for South Africa's withdrawal. Identical letters were sent by the Minister of Justice to the Speaker of the National Assembly and the Chairperson of the NCOP on the 20th and the 21st of October 2016, advising them of Cabinet's decision to withdraw and the reasons for the withdrawal. The Minister also informed Parliament that he intended to table a bill repealing the implementation of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. There were two preliminary matters that I wish to raise regarding this.
Let me just check something. Is she audible?
Yeah.
Okay. You can just bring the mic nearer.
Yes. Firstly.
Yes, that's why I was. Yeah, I suspected that. But there's also a lot of. There are things I'm not comfortable with. Paperwork and other things. Can you start afresh from one, because you were saying three?
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Yes, Chair. On the 19th of October 2016, the National Executive took a decision to withdraw from the Rome Statute. A notice of withdrawal was subsequently signed by the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation to give effect to that decision and deposited it with the Secretary General of the United Nations. This triggered the process for South Africa's withdrawal. Identical letters were sent by the Minister of Justice to the Speaker of the National Assembly and the Chairperson of the NCOP on the 20th and 21st of October 2016, advising them of Cabinet's decision to withdraw and the reasons for the withdrawal. The Minister also informed Parliament that he intended to table a bill repealing the implementation of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court Act. There are two preliminary items that might be of interest to this committee to note. Firstly, two almost identical applications were made for direct access to the Constitutional Court, and an application was made in the North Gauteng High Court. The application to the Constitutional Court failed, as the court held that it was not in the interest of justice to hear the matter at that stage. The court held that it should follow the normal procedure for accessing the Constitutional Court if necessary. The applicants thus had the remaining application in the High Court to continue to pursue the matter. Secondly, the application was brought by one applicant, but it cited the Southern African Litigation Centre, Amnesty International, the Helen Suzman Foundation and others as respondents in the matter. These bodies were applicants and friends of the court in previous related matters that were litigated in our court. The court held that the applicant was prudent in citing the supporting respondents and they were thus allowed to be a part of the litigation. In the judgment, the North Gauteng High Court had to decide whether the decision by the National Executive to withdraw from the Rome Statute without prior parliamentary approval was constitutionally out of order. The court found that there was nothing patently unconstitutional at this stage about the National Executive's policy decision to withdraw from the Rome Statute. This was so because it is within its powers and competence to make such a decision. The court said that what is unconstitutional and invalid is the implementation of that decision, that is, the delivery of the notice of withdrawal without prior parliamentary approval. As a result, a declaration of invalidity of the notice of withdrawal, coupled with an order for the withdrawal of such notice, the court thought would suffice as an effective, just, and equitable remedy.
Yes, Honourable Lekota.
I'm completely lost. I can't find the
in this document, I can't see anything
of what she's doing. No. She's making a presentation. I'm not sure if she's necessarily following that specific document. But where she was now was the decision of the court and the reasons thereof. I think let's allow her to make a presentation because all of the members are going to get clarity seeking questions and make their comments, etc., etc. I think it's a bit interjecting here.
Chairperson, yes. You've been given a document that she started reading this document. And now there's nothing else that we can no longer see where she is now. We can't follow that.
So you want her to say page 3, it says this, page 4.
Because it's not in this document.
Can you continue? Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. The applicant sought an order on the presentation, Chairperson. I'm on slide 9. I've completed slide 9 and I'm moving on to slide 10. The presentation, Chairperson, isn't identical to the... I'm not reading the words on the PowerPoint presentation, but it is the essence of what is contained in the presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Can you put it on the slide, Chair? Because we're not following.
Honourable Kuala Banat.
Plus, Mr. Chair, but no cigar.
I'm
in fact Breitenbach. Thank you.
Breitenbach. My profuse apology.
Semi-blonde. Yeah. I'm kind of new to this committee, Mr. Chair, so forgive me if I'm out of order. But would it be possible to get a copy of the document that the presenter is reading off? This is very important. You know that it's very important to the Democratic Alliance. And we would like to see what it is that the presenter is reading off. She's the Chief State Law Advisor. I'm sure what she has to say is very important, and we'd like to see it, please. Thank you.
Noted, Honorable Lopez.
Yes, Chair, because she already said that she's not following on what we've been given. And I wanted to raise that point earlier on that we're just giving this document now. But I was happy when she started her presentation because I was following. But now she's reading something that we don't have on our hands. Is it possible, Chair, just to get her presentation on the slides in the meantime? That is my humble request.
Let's hear from you whether you have a slide.
I don't have a slide of the sure.
Chairperson,
thank you, Chairperson. I really appeal to the State Law Advisor to use the documents which were sent to us so that everyone can be comfortable. I think the other document, she can use it when we make, questions of clarity, please.
Are you comfortable now?
Yes.
Proceed.
On slide 10.
Even when we go back to report, wherever we report, we need to have those slides. We don't have it here. I promise you that it's impossible to follow that. Without the slides, you can't follow that. But where is the facility there?
Just hold your horses.
I will
use that. To which slide are you using the document that has been given to us?
So what's your problem?
And what slide or what page is it?
Page 10.
On our record, are you following? Page 10.
I think we're going to make change.
on this slide that we are presented with, she says she's on page 10. Yeah. But there are things that she said that has not been on the slide. So I think she has to start where she ended with this one.
Yeah.
Because we got lost in that translation between where she is and where he is now.
Okay. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Can I start?
Yeah, proceed.
Over. All right. The content of the presentation will deal with background issues, the issues that the court considered it had to deal with, the parties' arguments, both the applicants as well as the respondents, the court's findings relating to prior parliamentary approval, the court's comments on ex post facto approval, public participation, procedural irrationality, and whether or not the court should consider the substantive grounds of the challenge. The presentation will also deal with the remedy and the court's findings regarding the remedy and the order made. In the matter, the North Gauteng High Court had to decide in the main the question whether the decision of the National Executive to withdraw from the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court without prior parliamentary approval was constitutional and valid. The court found that this decision was unconstitutional and invalid. The reason for the decision are discussed hereafter. On the 19th of October 2016, the National Executive took a decision to withdraw from the Rome Statute. A notice of withdrawal was signed by the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation to give effect to that decision and deposited with the United Nations Security Council. In terms of Article 121(1) of the Rome Statute, the withdrawal of a party state from the Rome Statute takes effect 12 months after depositing of the notice. Thus, South Africa would cease to be a member exactly 1 year after the deposit of the notice with the United Nations Security Council. Identical letters were sent by the Minister of Justice to both the Speaker of the National Assembly and the Chairperson of the NCOP, advising them of Cabinet's decision to withdraw, the reasons for the withdrawal, and the Minister of Justice's intention to introduce a bill that would repeal the implementation of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court Act. On the 24th of October 2016, the applicant launched an application for direct access to the Constitutional Court, seeking to challenge the National Executive's decision to withdraw from the Rome Statute. It also launched a substantively identical application in the North Gauteng High Court, in the alternative and in the event that the Constitutional Court does not grant it direct access to it. On the 11th of November, the Constitutional Court refused the application for direct access on the basis that it is not in the interest of justice to hear the matter at that stage. As a result, the applicant fell back on its application in the North Gauteng High Court. It sought orders declaring unconstitutional and invalid the notice of withdrawal, the underlying cabinet decision to withdraw from the Rome Statute and to deliver the notice to the Secretary General of the United Nations initiating such withdrawal. Consequently, the applicant sought an order that the first respondent, who is the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, the second respondent, the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services, and the third respondent, the President of the Republic of South Africa, be directed to A, revoke the notice of withdrawal, and B, to take reasonable steps to terminate the process of withdrawal under Article 127 of the Rome Statute. The court identified the following issues, and these were A, whether prior parliamentary approval and the repeal of the Implementation Act were required before a notice of withdrawal was given, whether a process of public participation in Parliament should have preceded the lodging of the notice of withdrawal, whether the withdrawal was procedurally rational, if parliamentary approval is required for the delivery of the notice of withdrawal, whether such approval may be sought after the notice of withdrawal has been delivered. Fifthly, whether, if the process-based grounds succeed, the substantive grounds should nevertheless be considered. If one issue is dispositive of the matter, should other issues be considered? And whether the withdrawal was substantively rational. The court identified preliminary issues, and these were whether the state's obligation in terms of Section 7.2 of the Constitution precludes the withdrawal of the Rome Statute altogether, and if the application succeeds on any of the grounds, the just and equitable remedy to be granted. The applicants argued in the matter that, one, prior parliamentary approval was required before the notice of withdrawal was delivered to the United Nations. B, prior repeal of the Implementation Act was required before the notice of withdrawal was delivered to the United Nations. C, the delivery of the notice of withdrawal without prior consultation with Parliament was procedurally irrational. And D, the withdrawal from the Rome Statute breaches the state's obligations in terms of Section 7.2 of the Constitution. The government respondents argued that prior parliamentary approval is not required for the notice of withdrawal to be given because Section 231 contains no such provision. Secondly, in any event, prior parliamentary approval is being obtained. C, because there is no express provision in Section 231 of the Constitution for a provision relating to the withdrawal, reading into the Constitution is unwarranted. And this argument, the reading in being unwarranted, is premised on the following four distinct grounds. Government respondents argued that because it is the National Executive's primary role in international relations to conclude treaties and not that of Parliament, the legal requirement, and that is prior approval of Parliament, not being explicit in the Constitution, should not be lightly implied or read into the Constitution. They further argued that since the original function of concluding treaties is not that of Parliament, but of the National Executive, parliamentary approval is only required in order for a concluded treaty to become binding. Thirdly, their argument was premised on the ground that in international law, a notice of withdrawal from an international agreement does not require approval. And lastly, parliamentary approval is only required for an international agreement as contemplated in Section 231 of the Constitution, not for the withdrawal. Okay. The court dealt with a number of areas in its judgment. On prior parliamentary approval, the court said, in dealing with this issue, the court stated that 231 of the Constitution must be the point of departure, since the question is whether the National Executive is entitled to decide on the withdrawal and execute its decision without the involvement of the legislature and therefore seek legislative approval as it seems to do. The court, relying on the explanation of Section 231 by the Constitutional Court in the Glenister matter, held as follows. From the exposition of Section 231, there is no question that the power to conduct international relations and to conclude treaties has been constitutionally conferred upon the National Executive in terms of Section 231(1). But that power is fettered by Section 231(2) and 4, which enjoins the National Executive to engage Parliament. The section therefore clearly delineates the powers between the National Executive and Parliament. The only power the National Executive has to bind the country to international agreements without parliamentary involvement is in Section 231(3), with which we are not concerned here. Any other international agreement must be approved by Parliament in terms of Section 231(2) to be binding on the country. Thus, once Parliament approves the agreement, internationally the country becomes bound by that agreement. Domestically, the process is completed by Parliament enacting such international agreement as national law in terms of Section 231(4). Government respondents argued that in terms of Section 231(1) and 2 of the Constitution, the National Executive first negotiates and signs an international agreement. Parliament thereafter approves the agreement to bind the country. The process of withdrawal should follow the same route, with the National Executive first taking the decision, followed by parliamentary approval. The Court stated that it does not agree with this argument, because if this argument is accepted, it would mean that the act of delivering a notice of withdrawal would be equated to the conclusion and signature during the making of an international treaty, which does not require prior parliamentary approval, but can subsequently be ratified. The Court stated that this cannot be the case, because the act of signing a treaty has no direct legal consequences, while, by contrast, the delivery of a notice of withdrawal has concrete legal effects in international law, as it terminates treaty obligations, albeit on a deferred basis in the present case. Regarding Section 231 of the Constitution, the Court summarized its findings as follows. In sum, since the structure of Section 231, the National Executive requires prior parliamentary approval to bind South Africa to an international agreement, there is no cogent reason why the withdrawal from such agreement should be different. The National Executive did not have the power to deliver the notice of withdrawal without prior parliamentary approval. The inescapable conclusion must therefore be that the notice of withdrawal requires the imprimatur of Parliament before it is delivered to the United Nations. Thus, the National Executive's decision to deliver the notice of withdrawal without obtaining prior parliamentary approval violated Section 231(2) of the Constitution and breached the separations of powers doctrine enshrined in that section. The second area the Court concentrated on was the ex post facto approval. Regarding the government respondent's argument that the National Executive has complied with the requirement for parliamentary approval by virtue of the fact that the request to approve the notice of withdrawal and the repeal of the Implementation Act Bill are pending before Parliament, the Court stated that the government respondents are raising the question whether retrospective approval by Parliament would cure any defects in the process followed for the notice of withdrawal. Thus, the question that arises is whether this question has become academic. The Court stated that the question is not academic for the following reasons. Constitutionally, the doctrine of separation of powers is implicated because the National Executive had purported to exercise power it constitutionally does not have. Its conduct is invalid and has no effect in law. B. Practically, although the notice of withdrawal does not take effect immediately, it does not mean that its delivery has no consequences until the effective date. The ICC and member states to the Rome Statute must begin preparing for the exit, for its existence without South Africa. Elaborate transitional arrangements must be put in place. On the area of public participation, the Court held, regarding the applicant's argument that public participation had been circumvented by the National Executive's delivery of the notice of withdrawal without prior parliamentary approval, the Court stated that it is not necessary to consider this argument in any detail because of the finding of the Court that parliamentary approval of the notice of withdrawal and the repeal of the Implementation Act are required before the notice is delivered to the United Nations. Thus, the court found that the notice of withdrawal has been invalidly delivered. As a result, it has to be revoked. However, the court emphasized that parliamentary process to repeal the Implementation Act should take its course. None of the parties had suggested that that process, and the process that the court is referring to is the consideration of the repeal bill, is tainted. On procedural irregularity, the court said that the requirement for rationality, is that government action must be rationally connected to a legitimate government purpose. The main reason put forward by the National Executive for delivering the notice of withdrawal was that the Rome Statute impedes its role in diplomatic and peacekeeping efforts on the continent, as it is required to arrest on its soil sitting heads of state against whom the ICC has issued warrants of arrest. By withdrawing from the Rome Statute, so was the argument, government would be free to pursue its peacemaker role on the continent without the obligation to arrest the indicted heads of state. It would be free to give immunity to such leaders. The court, however, stated that the above argument ignores the effect of the Implementation Act, and as a result, while internationally the ICC would give effect to the notice of withdrawal, domestically, government would be obliged, among others, to arrest and surrender the indicted leaders as long as the Implementation Act is in force. It would not be permissible to grant the immunity it envisages. Government argued that the notice of withdrawal does not take effect until October 2017, and by that time the Implementation Act would have been repealed. The court stated that the fact that the National Executive is ordering the legislature to finalize its process of considering the repeal bill before the effective date of 18 October 2017 is impermissible. In summary, the court found as follows regarding the process-based challenges. We find, on a construction of Section 231 of the Constitution, that prior parliamentary approval and the repeal of the Implementation Act are required before the notice of withdrawal from the Rome Statute is delivered by the National Executive to the United Nations. Also, that the delivery of the notice of withdrawal was procedurally irrational. On whether or not the court should have considered the substantive grounds of the challenge. Here, the court is concerned with the allegation that withdrawal from the ICC and the Rome Statute offend Section 7.2 of the Constitution, the court said. The applicant argued that the notice of withdrawal constitutes a retrogressive measure in international relations, which derives South Africans of the protection afforded by the ICC, and that it undermines the protection afforded to victims of international crimes in other countries. The applicant further argued that this is in breach of the state's obligation under Section 7, Subsection 2 of the Constitution, which imposes obligations to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill constitutional rights. The court refrained from expressing any view on the substantive grounds, reasoning that this case must be distinguished from other cases of constitutional challenge because, here, it is a parliamentary process pending to consider the repeal bill. If the National Executive follows proper processes and Parliament passes the repeal bill, no fault would be attributable to the National Executive. If the complaint be that the legislation repealing the Implementation Act is unconstitutional on any ground, including all the substantive grounds advanced in the application, then such complaint would not be against the executive, but Parliament. The court stated that Section 172(1) of the Constitution provides that when deciding a constitutional matter within its power, a court must declare that any law or conduct that is inconsistent with the Constitution is invalid to the extent of its inconsistency. The court further indicated that the matter can be remedied as follows. Given that this court has refrained from expressing a view on the substantive policy decision by the National Executive to withdraw from the Rome Statute, it follows that it would be inappropriate to declare that decision unconstitutional as a standalone decision. There is nothing patently unconstitutional, at least at this stage, about the National Executive's policy decision to withdraw from the Rome Statute, because it is within its powers and competence to make such a decision. What is unconstitutional and invalid is the implementation of that decision, that is, the delivery of the notice of withdrawal without prior parliamentary approval. As a result, a declaration of invalidity of the notice of withdrawal, coupled with an order for the withdrawal of such notice, should suffice as an effective, just, and equitable remedy. The court then made the following order. 1. The notice of withdrawal from the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, signed by the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation on the 19th of October 2016, without prior parliamentary approval, is unconstitutional and invalid. The Cabinet decision to deliver the notice of withdrawal to the United Nations Secretary General without prior parliamentary approval is unconstitutional and invalid. The first, second, and third respondents, that is, the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services, and the President of the Republic of South Africa, are ordered to forthwith revoke the notice of withdrawal referred to. Fourth, the first, second, and third respondents, those of the government respondents, are ordered to pay the applicant's costs, including costs consequent upon employment of two counsel. And five, there is no costs order as between the intervening applicant, first, second, third, sixth, ninth, and tenth respondents. On the way forward, it has been published consequent to the judgment that Cabinet has noted the ruling by the North Gauteng High Court on South Africa's decision to withdraw from the International Criminal Court. The Cabinet statement reflects that Cabinet abides by the ruling and has established a technical task team to develop a compliance roadmap, and Cabinet is aware that Parliament is considering an appropriate course of action. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Ms. Johar, for the presentation. I would assume that there are no further inputs from your side, except that when it comes to answering questions that may come from members, you will help each other as a team. We have been joined by other members of Parliament who sit in this committee. It will not be necessary to go back to introduce them. Honourable members, can I hear you on the presentation on the decision of the court? Honourable Reitenbach, Rachnet Biki, Honourable Mkhalapa, is your hand up? Honourable Bergman. You didn't have to raise this much high. I would see it because it's light. It's white anyway. Okay. Honor Breitenbach.
Please let Mr. Bachalapa go first. I'll go after him. Are you sure? Okay. Thank you for the presentation. I have two questions. One, may I have the document that you were reading off first, a copy of that, please, if that's possible? I think everybody wants a copy of it.
Okay.
So if that could be arranged, please.
Yeah.
And then you refer to a technical task team to develop a compliance roadmap. Do you know how far that is? Do you know what the compliance roadmap contains? Is it possible to see that document? And I noticed that today a notice was served on the International Criminal Court withdrawing the withdrawal. So in fact, it has been done, that portion has been complied with, giving effect to the court order. So really, I just want a copy of your document, if that's possible, and then some more information about this compliance roadmap. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Breitenbach. Honourable Mukhalapa.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think what this judgment means for us as Parliament, it has put us back into the fold as the centre of legislation and accountability in this country. And I think it should be welcomed and you know, be commendable, because of, I think if you look at this, it's not about whether the withdrawal is justified or not. It's just about saying that Parliament should be at the centre of any legislative or any international engagement. And if you would recall, Chair, we've always been trying as a committee that
The international treaties, Parliament is seen as just a rubber stamp, one that just accent to whatever treaty that was there without properly engaging with it. And I think this is a classical example, and it gives us those powers as the committee of Parliament to ensure that in future when there are such treaties that we get engaged with, we get to engage them thoroughly rather than been seen as a rubber stamp. So essentially what this judgment says is that Parliament is at the center and Parliament must be taken seriously and Parliament must just do its job, because of I think as my colleague is saying, in terms of looking at the roadmap, it will be interesting to see what the roadmap means, because of this thing of doing things expediently by the executive, it's clearly costing the country in terms of a lot of litigations, legal litigations, and I think this one is one of those classical examples. But I just want to hear the state law advisor here in terms of the argument advanced by government that in page 20 where they are talking about the issue of diplomatic role and peacekeeping efforts on the continent, and being a justification why they would want to withdraw from the ICC. In your view, does diplomatic immunity supersedes the domestic law and our international law obligations? Because of, I think the argument advanced here that government wants to engage in peacekeeping and what, hence they don't want to be tied down by the Rome Statute in terms of warrants of arrest. Does it hold water in terms of which one comes first? It might be a chicken and egg question in terms of diplomatic immunity versus domestic law and international law obligation. But I think from the Democratic Alliance point of view, we welcome this judgment and we are looking forward to engaging in the process moving forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mukhalapa. Honourable Bergman.
Thanks, Chair. Just on the back of my colleague, the international treaties that we do sign, there's often an action and a reaction. And I'm worried that our withdrawal from the ICC, I mean, the fact that I'm sure we're still going to go ahead after correcting our steps, you know, there's always that impact. Now, yeah, we've got the legal advisors to respond and to present, but I'm sure the ministers, at least one of the ministers, should have been present, because ultimately, it's the ministry that makes the decision, the executive. Now, I'm getting very worried at this point in time about our advice given to our ministers or how the decisions are taken from the ministers, because there seems to be a lot of court cases that we're losing in terms of decisions that are taken from an executive level. And if it's going to fall on the reputation of our legal department, you're going to get to a stage where I don't even think we'd use the legal department for an uncontested divorce, because this is the amount of times we're landing up in court on the wrong end of the law. We have a constitution, and it seems that every judgment we get seems to attack our understanding and our knowledge and interpretation of the Constitution. And this must be embarrassing for Parliament. Now, if it is the legal department's advice to the ministers, then we need to interrogate the bureaucracy, so to speak. But if it's the executive themselves, then we need to look as a committee into another avenue and how we can take the decisions that are taken from the executive that always end up costing the citizens of South Africa. Now, South Africa has been summoned to The Hague on the 7th of April to explain why Omar al-Bashir was allowed to exit South Africa. Are we aware of this? And is this on the roadmap? Thank you. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Honorable Barakman. Perhaps let me quickly deal with the matter that you've raised first. Now, indeed, we would have loved to have the Minister of Justice here. We were advised that the Minister is off sick. So, Honorable Faith Motambi is the acting Minister. And she has written an apology to say that she's deploying or assigning the officials that are presenting to us. Thank you very much. Honorable, before Honorable Lekota, there's Honorable Hlophe. You are noted, Honorable Lekota.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to get a clarity on the presentation itself. I take your clarification in terms of why the minister is not here, because it means that the agenda was also misleading, because we're looking for actually the minister here. Because some of the things that are very important issues, I think the department can't it needs a particular thing to be accountable here. But nevertheless, we'll just engage with the presentation because I think it's our job. But Chair, just from you, just to get it clear, because my understanding is that this case is
DA versus Minister of International Relations. And correctly so, a Committee of International Relations and Cooperation. If it was not going to be correct, if the department firstly come and make a presentation to us as a committee members, firstly before the Department of Justice, although I understand that they also have a jurisdiction on the matter, but procedurally, I think it will be very prudent for the department itself, because we serve in this committee and the Minister of International Relations is accountable to this committee. Just to be have some inside information as a committee, that's one, Chair. And on the presentation itself, Chair, on page 5, the last paragraph, that the Minister also informed the National Assembly and National Council of Provinces that he intended to table a bill, blah, 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 blah. And there was a letter that was written to the National Chair, Speaker, and NCOP. My question is, did they reply? Or you just wrote a letter as a department and there was silence? Because that's what the court is pinpointing, which is the process was supposed to be taken by Parliament. So you wrote a letter, correctly so, to say to NCOP Chair and the National Speaker that you are intended to withdraw from the Rome Statute. But did Parliament reply to you? Because we are in this mess of those things, that the Parliament can't hold the executive in accountable. And also on page 20, Chair, if I remember very well, on our last meeting, we said to a committee, we are not giving details on some of the information that is happening internationally. One of the reasons, one of the arguments here, you are saying you wanted to withdraw from the ICC in order to play a role at a continental level. But my question is, what is the alternative? If you want to withdraw to ICC, of which I must also be clear, as the EFF, we don't have a problem for that. But if there is no other alternative body, what is the way forward? We were told that there is an Abuja Treaty that was signed in 1989, of which there's no follow-up. If we withdraw to ICC, then what next? Thank you, Chair. Let me just put it.
Thank you very much, Honorable Hlophe. Honorable Lekota, you're on the floor.
Well, Chairperson, first of all, I think that we ourselves must be
very clear whose role is to do what. Insofar as the political heads of the department are not here, I think we are making a serious mistake to think that we can pin down members of the bureaucracy to answer political questions. Why do we think that somebody who is employed to give a legal opinion when a request is so done, that person must now take responsibility for the political decisions of those who occupy political positions? The policy of government is not made by these employees of the department. They are experts to assist the politicians how to do things, not to decide for them, not to answer what is going to happen if we withdraw from the ICC. That question must be answered by the ministers here. Now, I find it very embarrassing that we place ourselves in a position we confront, sardines when the sharks are away. We need the sharks here and then deal with those sharks. Because these are innocent people, these are experts. And I really want to appeal to you, Chair, to say that we have now been given this report, which should have been done by the minister. This can be done because the court has taken the decision, and the lady has done that, I think, quite competently now, save for this, the roadmap and this thing that she can just send to us. But now to interrogate them, I think we are missing the point. And I would appeal that note our questions and ask the ministers to come here and come and answer for themselves so the country can hear as we hold them to account. I don't want to hold a bureaucrat to account. I want to hold a politician to account why they took the decisions they took, why they did not arrest Omar Bashir. We as a country were in the Sudan, in the Darfur. I was the Minister of Defense at the time, when the people were being slaughtered there. And we want them to account, and we reported that we filed when we came back. Why did they not arrest this individual who broke the law when we were busy with the peacekeeping missions in the Darfur and elsewhere? This country cannot again be a polecat of the world by being seen as protecting, people who are killing defenseless Africans in the continent. I thank you, sir.
Honorable, thank you very much, Honorable Lekota. Honorable Mwango.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I think I want to concur with the contribution made by the last speaker in that we would be barking at the wrong tree, as it were, if we want to ask political questions to actually legal technocrats. I have a lot of questions to ask the minister, and I'm expecting him to actually give answers to that. And certainly I cannot expect any answers on my questions from the legal experts. But I do want to say that to welcome the decision of the court in that it actually helped a great deal to restore the constitutional obligation of our parliament insofar as issues of international treaties are concerned, because very often parliament is actually just sidelined and overlooked on crucial matters like this. And I do not understand how it actually eluded even our legal technocrats, this simple principle of going out in a manner in which you actually went in. Because when the government acceded to the Rome Statute, Parliament was involved. Now, for the life of me, how did they think that they could actually, now when they want to go out, simply just ignore Parliament? Mm-hmm. You know, you go out through the door you went in. Now they wanted to actually leave the statue through the window. That is just not on. This is, to me, you know, it baffles my mind. South Africa cannot have its cake and eat it. You know, if we want to be champions for human rights in Africa and elsewhere, then we must actually be seen to be doing so. And we can't actually be on one hand wanting to be champions and on the other we want to dine and sup with actually people who are supreme violators of human rights. We can't do that. So I wish I could actually have the minister here to answer to all these questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Before I proceed, let me deal with the issues that have been raised up to this far, so that there is clarity and certainty. The committee, through me, did not invite the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation to come and make a presentation on this matter. We invited the Minister of Justice, who unfortunately is sick, is represented by Mutambi. That is the first thing I wanted to say. The second thing is that all the members, I think it's about three or four, who are now, if I should use the word, demand, that they are demanding that to get clarity on political questions and for purposes of accountability, the minister should come here. And I think I would persuade the committee to agree to that, that we still arrange a meeting where both ministers can come, but for now, because we're dealing with legislation or a legislative process, we only invited the other minister. I think that can be arranged. The third thing was that the third thing is that on all international treaties, and we're sitting with more or less 14, if I remember well, that I checked last year, about 14 different international treaties affecting other portfolio committees and departments. All of them, if those treaties must be ratified and or they must withdraw, they have to touch base with us. Now, I just want to say to the members that the Portfolio Committee on Justice, whatever it will be doing on behalf of Parliament, has to work very closely with us to the extent that it affects the work of this committee. And of course, I hope then we can agree that both ministers will be invited to come and make a presentation. The Minister of International Relations, because she was assigned by Cabinet to deposit the instrument of withdrawal to the Secretary General as a representative of South Africa, and the Minister of Justice, because he had to address the Assembly of State Parties, as it were. So we will make that arrangement. I see that there are further comments and hands. Honorable Raputi. Are you the only one? Okay.
Yeah.
Khoikole? Katebe?
Okay. Yes, I just wanted to say thank you very much, ma'am, for the presentation that you gave us, and to all the women, happy International Women's Day.
Oh, Amanda.
Thank you.
Amanda.
Oh, man.
Thank you. No, Chairperson, I was just going to say that, you know, what is important in this committee is about the Ubuntu attributes that prevailed in the committee. But today, really, it was really something that I didn't understand. What really, you know, binds us here is kindness, politeness, and, you know, and caring. So some of the people who are visitors here, they really demonstrated very uncaring and unpoliteness kind of attitude towards my learned friend today. I think it is uncalled for, and those who did that, they must really apologize. I thank you.
Well, it's Well, she doesn't want to be explicit. I almost thought I should say people should not be called sardines, but I just thought it's not quite very material, you know. And the others were called sharks. Now, I think all fish are not happy with this. Or maybe they are, that they are actually very important. Okay. Honorable Raputi? You are done. Honorable Khatebe?
All right. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I think that, as we know very well, that the Portfolio Committee is an extension of Parliament. Being an extension of Parliament, it means that all the rules of Parliament applies at the Portfolio Committee level. And there are previous rulings that people cannot be compared to animals. It's a fact. That one is a fact. According to Rule 84, the people cannot be referred to as animals. In particular, when it was referring to the ministers, in particular, as sharks, I think it is unparliamentary. It is unparliamentary, Chair. It must be ruled upon. It must be ruled upon. It cannot be agreed. We cannot agree on that. Those are the rules of Parliament. Those are the procedures of Parliament which must be respected, even in a committee level, Chair. And then, on behalf of the African National Congress, Chairperson, I really appreciate the presentation which was presented to us today. First of all, the legal advice which was given to the Cabinet that it must not go and appeal the decision of the High Court. Because if you look at the essence of the decision of this court, it does not cast aspersion on the role or on the decision by the executive to withdraw from the ICC. The executive has got a privilege to do that. It can do it. It is a decision. The only thing which was flawed was the issue of the process, of which it can be rectified. So I think that although they are compared to small fishes, but I think that decision, that advice which they gave was very big, was very high, it was respectable. I think that that was the right decision to have, the right advice to have given to the Cabinet. Number two, Chair, I also appreciate that the Cabinet has already started complying with the court order. Because really, that's why South Africa is respected internationally, because it is a constitutional democracy. That's why when the court takes decisions, everyone must abide by those decisions. That's what the national executive has done. Hey, what are these gestures with Ms. President?
No, proceed. You have to ask the chair to make that determination. Honorable Breitenbach, can we allow the presenter to be heard? Proceed, please. Honorable Breitenbach, no. I'm deep allowing that. Proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think what the court has done, has made a good decision around this issue. That's why that as the African National Congress, we welcome this decision. We note it and we welcome it. We support the executive in coming with the corrective measures to redress the process. Because the issue of the substantive issue, the court didn't make any expression around that. So I think that this thing might be delayed for a year. As it was going to be effective in October, it may be effective after we've done the parliamentary process, it can be done next year. But the issue now, it gives us a chance again. As Honorable Mkhalapa has said, we go and follow our procedures. We know the public participation model of Parliament. We'll just have to use it and consult with the stakeholders which are interested, and then we redress the process and do what the court has done. Really, this judgment was highly appreciated. Also, the input from the legal advice, it was good. We really appreciate it. I think we must continue supporting the executive in doing its job. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Honorable Shoppe, you want to come back?
Yes, Chairman. I'm going to continue support executive is accountable to Parliament. It's our job for the executive to be accountable here. They've done wrong. The court has told them to their face that they are wrong. They don't even understand their constitutional power. So there's no way that you can support them. They must be accountable. But the point that I want to make, Chair, is that also on page 26, I think it must be noted, because this is very, very, very sad. On page 26.4, the first, second, and third respondent are ordered to pay the applicant's cost. So, this money, where it will come from? Definitely this money will come from the taxpayers' money. And we must not allow that. This is very sad. Because each time the government is doing something wrong and is reprimanded by the court, so the taxpayers are also get the pinch. It must be come to a stop. That's why, Honorable Chief Whip of this committee, we are not going to support what you are saying. Because each time they be taken to court and they are ordered to pay the cost, is the taxpayers' money. They are not paying from their pocket. Otherwise, we can take a decision here. Which when they have to pay this cost, they must pay from their own pockets, not to use the taxpayers' money.
Honorable Kota, can I now hear you on the fishes and the sharks? And sometimes, that's my own expression now. People sometimes say chasing lizards instead of crocodiles. Can I now hear you?
I don't want to open an English class.
I honestly don't want to do that. Because even in our mother tongue, there are things called figures of speech. Now, if I have to start here, that this is a simile. I didn't say that lady is a sardine. I said, we cannot attack the sardines when the sharks are away. It's a figure of speech to say the people who are in authority, who should be answering our questions, are not here. Now, it's very easy for me to take a nopkiri and clobber all these people who have no powers, such as I have. The minister is an elected person like I'm elected. These people are employees. They are experts. They advise us how best to do the things that they are trained to know, and they know how those things should be done. I doubt if that lady or any one of these members of the administration understood me to mean that they are sardines. They are not sardines, they are human beings. So this is a simile. It's like exaggeration. Exaggeration is another form of speech. You understand? So if my colleagues there don't understand a figure of speech, they can't say I'm out of order. They are out of order, in fact. And I appeal to you, Chairperson, you know. You see, in our mother, in Sesotho, for instance, you can say to somebody, Utabalehala. Now, lehala is spinach cooked with milk. Lehala, murateng is one that's cooked with water. The two don't taste the same. The one with milk is, and the other one, well, you know, so. So when you say that, you are not saying the person you're talking to is spinach.
No, it's a tete.
I say it. Because it's a figure of speech. In all languages, people do that. You see, so I'm sorry that this was, you know, that my colleagues have misunderstood entirely what I said. But I'm not out of order at all, sir. I'm actually absolutely in order. I thank you.
Now I will come back to this matter, and I'm going to share with you just a very short anecdote. In fact, let me do it right away. When I was at the University of the North, there was this Professor Tipenar who spoke Sipedi very well. He was African speaking. Now, he once said to us, when you are referring to a very kind person in Sipedi or Sesotho, you say, Munayo Kingu. This person is a sheep. Because when you slaughter a sheep, it doesn't cry, it doesn't make noise. In Sipedi, you can say Munayo o Mutuo Kingu. He even said, but you can't say that in Afrikaans. You can't say Yiri man or he means it's a scalp. You see, so it reminds me of things like that. It depends on how it sits with the person. I agree with you that it is a figure of speech, but I must also say, personally, where do I differ? If you say these officials are just officials and the ministers are elected like us, like we are public representatives, it does, to some extent, say that the public representatives are more important than the officials. I think the insistence should be that the ministers must be held to account by members of parliament, and precisely for that reason, they must be invited to come back. So that in future, we don't refer to the officials as lizards or as sardines because they are not members of parliament or they are not public representatives. It may be very distasteful to the officials, including those that we are working with here in parliament. And to that extent, my ruling would be that Honorable Kwata, do withdraw it. Can I request you to,
I'm sorry. I'm really very sorry. I'm not doing it. I simply refuse. But never mind me. And nobody other than the people who are speaking there.
No.
I haven't noticed anything that says that anybody here thought I was ridiculing them. I refuse.
No.
I'm not doing that.
No.
Can I hear?
No.
Thank you, Chairperson. I still maintain that the ministers were referred to as sharks. And
no.
There are previous rulings in the House
no.
which refer to the fact that people cannot be compared to animals.
No,
which people cannot be compared to animals, Chair.
No.
If necessary, Chair, you have made a ruling and that member refuses to comply with ruling, read the ruling, do what is necessary.
No, you are not on the floor. I have not recognized you, Honor Mukhalapa. Honor Mukhalapa, I have not recognized you.
Yeah.
I have not recognized you. Raise your hand up. Raise your hand up so that I recognize you. You are not on the floor. Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Absolutely. I want to point out to the Honorable Khadeli that there may be a portion of the judgment that he missed. In fact, the court found regarding Section 231 that the National Executive's decision to deliver the notice of withdrawal without obtaining prior parliamentary approval violated Section 231(2) of the Constitution. That is wrong. And breached the separation of power doctrine enshrined in that section. That is wrong. And that's why they got a question that did. So in fact, people did do something wrong. So I can't be sitting here pretending no one did.
Any further? No.
I can lodge a complaint.
Mukhalapa.
I'm not
Mukhalapa. Raise your hand and speak. Mukhalapa. I'm saying that you must raise your hand and speak. Honor Bergman.
Chair, it's exactly this kind of interpretation that has got us into trouble before and is embarrassing all the time. The people inside on the field don't seem to be embarrassed. The people watching from the outside that are getting embarrassed for us. What Honorable Lakota has said is perfectly acceptable in any language whatsoever that you use. This is being televised. You know, we've got a report that's interrogated. We can't be stuck on something that is totally irrelevant, totally acceptable in any eyes of any chair, any scenery that we sit in. As my colleague has said, if there's a problem,
Whip feels strongly about this. let him refer it to the Rules Committee. But we cannot waste any more time on something that's so frivolous compared to what we really have to interrogate at this stage.
Honorable Khalapa?
I rest my case.
Honorable Molefe?
Chair, I think that we have noted that the court rules in favor of the DA on this matter, and that the executive has welcomed the decision of the court and are in fact starting to comply with the decision of the court in that they found the application. Also, members have said here that they would like the executive to come to account, and I think they have agreed that the court is coming to account. To the as far as I can see, that is where the matter ends.
Thank you.
Yes, Honorable Kota, on your matter, I'll take advice on this matter and check the applicable rule and come back to you and the committee. Honorable Maila. Order. No order.
Because it reaffirms the principle and doctrine of separation of powers and the rule of law. It's quite well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think the matter is put paid to. But if there are any comments from your side, can we hear you? Okay, the last thing is, I think there are two things we must just finalize the matter on. One is that we have noted the presentation and the decision of the court as noted by Cabinet. The second thing is that we are going to invite the ministers. It would be good that we should have both of them in the same sitting. In the same sitting of the portfolio committee to make the presentation. And the last one is that I am going to confer with the chair of a justice committee and of course inform the other members here on how parliament is going to be seized with this matter. I think those would be the three things that I would say, at least for now. Yes. Thank you very much. So you can be released or you can also remain. Now we are going to take a presentation from the Department of Defense and Military Veterans on the Foreign Service Bill. Oh, okay. Let's have a 7-minute break just to allow people to leave.
I'm
Memkagato, Sizani, who's going to speak? Yokulmawe. No, Lava, they are playing to the Calare. They are playing to the media. I want. No, what you know, Ale, Ubuntrawa, all those things. I want. I'm going to let you rule the young years. Rule one?
Take forever before
I'm not going to be able to do it. Okay. It's a simile. And you know what? I'll tell you something about this thing. I remember that when we were dealing in the African Union, and we were dealing with the issues of corruption in government and all of that, this phrase was actually the Tanzanians were actually saying, there was a Tanzanian minister who was saying, you know, we set up this corruption and so forth. But what now has happened is that this body having been set, they're concentrating on arresting all these small people, defenseless people. Meantime, they don't do anything about the real people who are stealing big money in government. And he then said, actually people have now composed a saying in Tanzania, saying that the Sardines are suffering while the Shanks are still free. It's not even my original idea.
No, they're going to be correct.
While the South African Parliament has got its own rules, it's got its own rules, it has got its own decision, which must be respected.
Hadi, my male, can you listen to me? When is it an Ushboga Sahoma? Tim Kool, are you a tree? Listen to that. Some people keep at home. Baba, you keep on going.
Yeah.
Are you going to say, no, this is a tree, this is an animal?
No,
parliament, you will not say,
it's not exactly.
The context in any matter is important.
Are you on the window, but some of
them? Oh,
Let me rush to the toilet.
I'm going to say we must no longer accept people from
edge.
Honourable members, let's resume our business, please. Members, defense, get organized. Can we have order? Close that door, please. officials from Department of Defense and Military Veterans, most welcome. Let me just explain one or two things. It is that we have been taking presentations every Wednesday from departments that were cited by the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, who were affected or going to be affected by some of the provisions of this bill, to the extent that they too are players in the or are involved in the international arena. Just to give you one or two examples, Home Affairs came here and said, look, this bill is going to affect us when it comes to this particular operational matter or this political decision or legal provision. Public Works did also indicate areas that they felt that in terms of mandate, they were exclusively falling within the purview of their own responsibilities and not that of DERCO. So things like that. The DPSA was about, you know, the officials who's going to ultimately pay them, all of those things. And ultimately, we'll also hear unions, because the officials in whatever department also belong to different unions, things like that. So I'm just saying it is in that context that we're hearing you. We've had a public seminar on the bill. We are now engaging departments, and thereafter we will meet other stakeholders and then finally have a clause-by-clause presentation. But I have also said to the committee 6 times, and that this I think is to also assist the members. I've said to the committee secretary and the content advisor that all the drafts that would have been presented to us when we conclude this business, we'll take them back to all the departments and say, is this finally, can you just check, finally is this what you were saying to us, can you firm it up? Because we must say, we'll then call the department and say, defense actually said this, DPSA this, but it must be your views. So we'll give you the draft, you will finalize it, then we'll engage the department to finalize the process. And with that, I want to welcome you once again. And we have Brigadier General M. Sizani and Brigadier General T. M. Mkagato. Over to you. I don't know who's going to present. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair, the Honorable Members of Parliament. We are from the South African National Defence Force.
It's on there, then, eh?
Yes. I'm Brigadier General M. Sizani, together with my colleague, Brigadier General Mkagato, on behalf of our Chief of the Defence, Minister of Defence. We stand ready to present to you as the military expression of the people of South Africa the defense approach to the bill. In the main, I wish to state from the very onset that we've been engaged with DERCO. We have provided inputs to the process. We will therefore articulate on all those inputs as informed by us as the very dependable capability of yourself. We three approaches which I will use to articulate our inputs to the bill first is we seek to bring into the fore the vital importance of defense diplomacy as the component element of international relations. It's just a preamble to our written script.
Chen, sorry for interruption. We don't have a presentation or the notes or the scripts. How do we proceed on this one? Do we open our ears and take it by the ear?
Do you have a written? Okay, before that, Honourable Mpumlwana.
I think we know the bill, we know the bill in front of us. If they would say, and the issue is
very clear,
and
there's a lady who forgot to this.
Can I give you a question, Chair?
Yes.
There is nothing ready now to be distributed at the moment. We can listen to what he's saying because what he's talking to is talking to the base, and the issues are very clear. Not the question of administration in the foreign service. And I don't think we should make a meal at all. We are used to this thing, but we can take notes if you want to ask any questions. And also the Secretariat. I don't think there's anything that is ready, and we should not quarrel about that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, but we can still, department, we still say that do send us a presentation, even if it's not done today, so that we can send to the members, because it must say section 6, which says this, section 11, which says this, is affecting us, the section 3, were wholly supportive, things like that. Yeah. Proceed.
Chairperson, first point of order, you know we're doing things unusual in this country. I don't understand what's going on here. But we can't proceed like this. It's a known and a norm that you cannot come to Parliament and then say that members will take it by the ear. We can't have a presentation. Does it mean that that's why they call Parliament just the other step? Because of we come here, you take it by the ear, it's certain, it's sure that there are things that you're going to miss in the process. Other than when you have a presentation where you can follow through. We can't do things like this. I mean, we're running this committee now like a spaza show.
Well, I take exception. I certainly take exception that I'm running the committee like a spaza show. I'm going to have to hear all of us on this one, on whether we insist we can only have this meeting if there is a presentation or if we can proceed in the way that I was suggesting, and I will make us vote ultimately. Honorable Chope.
Thank you, Chair. No, Chair, it's going to be very difficult just to listen to a presentation, unless we are told to go to the presentation. It's one page, it's two pages, it's three pages. So as a committee, we can take a decision on those basis. Now the presenter is started. We don't know if it's going to be very long or it's going to be very short. Unless we are clarified, there's no presentation that is prepared for the committee members, but the presentation is then that long, so we can decide upon. I don't know, I'm still speaking, Chair. I don't know why the hands are up.
Proceed.
Yes. I was emphasizing on that, Chair, unless we can be verified, no, there's no problem. It's only one page presentation. Maybe we can sum up that one. But yeah, it's unusual, Chair, which you just come and be told that there's no presentation that is prepared. It's very unusual.
Are you done?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Honorable Raputi, followed by Molefe.
Yeah.
And Khateb, eh?
Yeah. If we can just get how many pages, and in the meantime, they can go and do, reproduce those pages. Or if they bought it via the, what is it? Yeah, soft copy, so that we can send it to us, all of us have got them, so that we can be able to engage. Parliament gives us laptops, iPads, and all those things. So then we can be able to be technologically relevant. So that is it. If you've got it on your, do you have it? He can send it to you or to the secretary, and then he can send it to us. We can engage it on our iPads. That is that and simple. And this paper thing, I think it must finish.
No, no. The issue at hand is whether this meeting must proceed without a presentation. Or with a presentation, and I'm going to say let me hear all of you and vote on the matter. Honorable Ife, Mwango noted, you'll come after Khate.
Chair, I'm afraid I'm also new here, but my understanding is that General Sudani was going to make comments on the bill, which do not necessarily refer to a presentation or a document that we had prior to this. These comments will be on record. If we require to make a transcript of this comment, it can be made. I think that I can organize it. And perhaps the general can also submit a summary of this comment after the meeting in a day or two. But my understanding was that you were just making comments on the bill, not necessarily a presentation or even a document.
Thank you. Honorable Khatebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I'd like to say that generally the presentations which are brought before the Portfolio Committee are actually sent even before the Portfolio Committee sits. Yes. I think that there was an omission on the side of the department. Yes. But then the big question you have to ask is we move forward with this meeting or not. Mm-hmm. But because this is not, we are not dealing with this bill clause by clause now, I think that what the department can do, as they comment, they just refer to the specific clauses of the bill. But then they must give us an undertaking
that all their comments which they have made by the, before the end of the day today, those comments must sit with the committee secretary, and the committee secretary ensures that by tomorrow we should have all received those comments. I think if you can take it that way, Chair, it will be okay. Because to say that they must return to Pretoria now, it will be wrong. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Mwango, followed by Kenny.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also wanted to say that, yes, it is actually unusual that we are going to be discussing a matter without, you know, some documents in front of us. But the fact that, the delegation from the Defense Department are here all the way from Pretoria, I think it would be unfair to actually to send them away, notwithstanding the fact that, of course, the general, you know, practice has actually been, has not been followed. So I would be prepared to listen to them with in the hope that in a very short space of time we will get, you know, their input in you know, reduced into paper, so that I could be able to report back to my caucus on Thursday, tomorrow, in fact, what transpired, what is the view of the Department of Defense on the issue of the of this bill, and my study group as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Kenny.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also share the same sentiment that emanates from my colleague's input. Really, at the end of the day, what we want to hear is their concerns on the bill, which really needed to be, have been drafted, just so that we have a concern in this one, we don't agree with this one, we have a concern owing to the department. So I also concur to Honorable Khadim when he says that you can now do the exercise, as you are saying, we are concerned about this expenditure of coming, of them coming all the way from Pretoria. Especially that maybe they have got the copy of the bill, so that they can refer, as we're also going to do the same, because we've got the copies of the bill. Where are their concerns? It's what section is just critical for the department. Thank you very much.
Arab Maila.
Thank you, Chair. I echo the sentiments of my colleagues that obviously there was an omission. However, we are in a situation where we can't say let's postpone the meeting because of that omission. So let's continue. Maybe the department will make an undertaking, as suggested by Honorable Khadebe, that their presentation will be made available to us. But lastly, Chair, to say, the mere fact that, the fact that you were able to engage in this exercise shows us that you are not running this thing like your spaza show. So you are spot on.
Thank you very much. I have now heard all of us. I think the general dominant view, department, the general majority view, is that you were supposed to come with a presentation, and now that it is not there, we allow you to proceed, and then shortly you must give us the presentation, and then it will be sent to the members. The question is, when can we get that? Unwang of no report cocker, sir.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, we will, with immediate effect tomorrow, the lady to provide the honorable members the Department of Defense inputs on the bill. They stand ready, we will read direct from them. We stand ready to share that with yourselves, so that next day I can process. Thank you.
kahle kahle uyiphethe le presentation nedi akwenziwa amakopi.
Yes, sir, we have the written inputs not prepared as a presentation. These are all inputs that deals with our expression on the say definition. We then note those areas which we fall short of our own expectation. It covers the entire spectrum of the bill. It tallies with what is in the bill and what is here. We do not have any problem to share with members of Parliament.
Okay. Now you say we can get this by tomorrow.
Sir, tomorrow it will be signed off from the Department of Defense directed to your office.
Okay. Now committee secretary, ne? Usikwela, and then uzo distribute to all the members. But of course there's a department yet there that I did not speak about. We have said that let them sit in all the meetings where other departments are presenting so that they take note of the support or objections or comments that other departments are making. They are also robbed of that ability without a document. Nonetheless, proceed.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Once more, we must express our apology for us to present into this fashion. As soldiers, at times we get briefs, and we follow those briefs as very disciplined soldiers. But to continue from our approach to the bill, just on three aspects which, when we look at the bill, that we felt perhaps more... First, more recognition of defense diplomacy and its activities as an extension of foreign policy ought to find expression on the bill. The facets of defense diplomacy that cover the strategic as well as military strategic level ought to find expression on the bill. And lastly, expressly recognizing the defense instrument as an instrument to enhance international relation. It's something that entirely informs our understanding of the bill. To start with the general comments on the bill, my presentation will be structured as a general comments, and then we will go as per you have in the bill, say the definitions. Four aspects on our general comments. We restate that the Department of Defense participates in foreign relations of the Republic of South Africa through, amongst others, by the placement of military, naval, or air attaches as referred in the Vienna Convention at RSA diplomatic missions abroad, as well as through secondment of military personnel to international organizations such as United Nations or and the AU. Although the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations speaks of military, naval and air attaches in terms of Article 7 thereof, the term defense attaché will therefore be used herein to refer to the collective wholesome that entails both your naval or your air attaché, expressly written on the Vienna Convention. Such defense attachés forms part of the members of the diplomatic staff of a mission, and their names will usually be approved by the receiving state before the appointment to the staff of the mission, which is a norm. These standard military members are appointed to the Department of Defense under the Defense Act 2002, Act 42 of 2002, and they are and remain soldiers for the duration of their diplomatic service and are subjected to military disciplinary code only for the purposes of discipline. The defense attachés will be selected, trained, disciplined in instances of disciplinary infractions and vetted women security screened by the Department of Defense, while a command and control link between the Department of Defense and the defense attaché is retained through such defense attaché term of a diplomatic service. We therefore seek to express ourselves on page 1 of the bill on the definition. We note thereof that the definition of an employee as contained in the Foreign Service Bill firstly defines an employee as a person appointed by the Department of International Relations and Cooperation or to any other national department in terms of the Public Service Act 94, Act of 1994, Proclamation 103 of that Act of 1994. As defense, we therefore say this portion of the definition excludes the defense attaché as they are appointed to the Department of Defense in terms of the Defense Act of 2002 and may be problematic when you read together with clause 12.1F and will be pointed out here under. We further express ourselves that the narrow definition of the employee as per the bill then reads to proceeds to qualify the initial portion thereof by including members of the Foreign Service contemplated in Section 2 of our bill. This provision makes the definition untenable as the members of the Foreign Service contemplated in Clause 2 of the bill are not all appointed in terms of the Public Service Act of 1994, and the additional part of the definition and the latter part thereof are contradictory. See, we say the definition of a member of a Foreign Service refers now to a person who serves as a member of the Foreign Service and who is accredited to a foreign state as contemplated in Section 2. However, this definition we feel is flawed in that it unfortunately includes the very term that it is intending to define in terms of the definition. As the definition of the members of the Foreign Service makes reference to Clause 2, the members of the Foreign Service cannot be defined without reference to Clause 2. Clause 2.2 provides that Foreign Service consists of all South African missions and those of persons who serve in a position in the South African missions and who are accredited to a foreign state for a period of time that they hold that position, regardless of whether they are ordinarily employed by the Department of International Relations and Cooperation or by any other national department or appointed on a contractual basis for a fixed period. I think in that you will be referring to your LRP, your locally recruited person. Except for the reference to South Africa missions, the definition of members of the Foreign Service is then actually contained in the latter part of Clause 2.2, and this definition includes the defense attaches. We then say, consequently, the definition of an employee cannot include all members of the Foreign Service as it is firstly qualified by and or are limited to persons appointed in terms of Public Service Act of 1994. Department of Defense, therefore, understand that defense attaches cannot be qualified as employees for the purpose of the Foreign Service Bill, but they form an integral part of the Foreign Service if the definition of a member of a Foreign Service is read with the definition of a national department or and clause 2.2 thereof. The term employee is used only twice in the Foreign Service Bill in clause 11.2 that relates to offenses committed by any person, members of the Foreign Service and employees of the Department of International Relations, which is DERCO, and clause 12.1F that relates to the secondment of the employees to the service of a foreign state or entity, establishment, institution or organization outside South Africa and appears to be deficient in both instances. This issue will be referred more in detail here under. We raise that the issue of secondment is of such importance to the Department of Defense that the question must be raised whether this term should not be defined. The inclusion thereof of secondment persons to international organization in the Foreign Service may also be considered in clause 2.2 of the bill. Yeah. If I may continue. We further said, Chair, on the absence of application of the clause, the absence of an application clause, although not strictly necessarily, may have been useful in the present context. The reason is that a plain reading of the definition clauses with clause 2.2 leaves the reader uncertain as to what extent the Foreign Service Bill is applicable to defense attachés, as they are not included in employees, but seem to be included in members of the Foreign Service, as well as in the Foreign Service, and form part of a South African mission. An application clause that also specifically addressed the application of the Foreign Service Bill to military attachés may have been helpful, subject to the clarification of the other issues mentioned herein. An application clause could also have assisted to clarify the applicability of the Foreign Service Bill to the Department of Defense secondments to international organizations. This then, in the main, clarifies the Department of Defense challenge with respect to employee or what we may call it, maybe the minimalistic definition of employee. But we further said, in terms of foreign service, I think it's our paragraph 2, the current reading of the bill includes defense attachés in the foreign service created in clause 2.2. However, the discrepancy with relation to the definition of an employee and the omission of the defense attaché from that definition remains. It's included, whereas in the definition it's sort of omitted or silent. However, the provisions of clause 2.2 does not make it clear whether personnel who are seconded to the international organization, such as the military members seconded to multilateral organization, or in this case, let's say, to the African Union, or to other states, also form part of the Foreign Service. Therefore, the defense seek the clarity, first the expansion of the definition of an employee to cover the defense attaché, and secondly, on the Foreign Service also to give expression and recognition to seconded personnel to multilateral organizations. Before we go to paragraph 3 on the requirements for members of the Foreign Service, may I continue?
Yes, you have to make the entire presentation. We'll engage it thereafter.
Thank you, sir. But a trillion, the requirements for members of the Foreign Service, the provisions of clause 3.1 do not make provisions for the fact that defense attachés who are a part of the Foreign Service in terms of the current clause 2.2 are not subject to prescribed requirements from DERCO, but are subject only to the requirements and selection processes of the Department of Defense. The wording used in clause 3.3 refers to the transfer of a member of a foreign service and indicates that a member of a foreign service may not take up position at the South African mission until prescribed requirements have been met. Our understanding, a security clearance have been obtained and they are transfer approved by the DG DERCO. However, for defense attaché, there is not necessarily a transfer in the same manner as they will already be staffed in defense attaché post in the Department of Defense. Also, the Department of Defense approves who will be staffed in such post, and in this case, it is not the DG DERCO who approves defense attaches. But unfortunately, our expressions on the head of the mission, we as the Department of Defense therefore contend that there exists a reporting and control relationship between the head of the mission and the defense attaché. We recognize that. It is in sui generis and cannot be equated with the relationship with other members of the mission. The recognition of a dual reporting in terms of clear command and control between him as representing the Chief of the Defense and the Minister of Defense, with an obligation to also report to the head of the mission. We therefore say, as per para 4, that recognition is not expressly recognized. We therefore say the management function of the head of the mission does not extend to the point where it supersedes the command and control by the South African National Defense Force, and thus the statement in clause 4.1 that treats all members of the foreign service located at the mission the same is found deficient if it does not make provisions for the exception relating to defense attaches. The clarity in respect to the reporting channel, issues of accountability, I think that's what we express. We, on para 5, on recall of members of the Foreign Service, clause 5.1 provides that a member of the Foreign Service may be recalled if after an inquiry in the prescribed manner, such as the member is found guilty of misconduct in terms of the disciplinary code applicable to that member. However, the Department of Defense contends that DERCO cannot prescribe the disciplinary procedures applicable to the defense attaches, as this is already existing within the regulatory framework of the defense in the form of the military disciplinary codes and military disciplinary supplementary measures act of 1999, is act number 16 of 1999, and it provides for the manner of inquiry and discipline in its statutory manner already. Clause 5.3 does not make provisions for the exception relating to the defense attaches regarding the unique misconduct regime applicable to them, whether military offenses were committed inside or outside South Africa. We further, on paragraph 6 on Diplomatic Academy, express ourselves to say that the Department of Defense trains its own defense attaches. They do not ordinarily undergo the training at the DERCO Diplomatic Academy. We therefore say clause 6 does not make provisions for this exception, as we read it from the bill. It's sort of a catch-all clause. We therefore say we have our own unique training in tandem also with the Diplomatic Academy, but completely unique for the unique role of a defense attaché. Para 11, we we further said that assets, although Clause 8 relates to immovable assets only, the issue of movable assets purchased with the funds of DOT but maintained, disposed of and possessed by DERCO may also be useful to address, and we are aware that it has caused confusion in the past between both departments. It's for the question of accountability and the prescript of Public Finance Management Act the accounting officer in our case, who accounts to Parliament on the assets of the department, remains the Chief of the National Defence Force and the Secretary for Defence, whereas the bill seeks to say the DG DERCO. On the issues of policies, codes and directive, we move to para 9. Recall, have I jumped in? Yeah. Okay, thank you. On the issues of policies, codes or directives, the applicability of the policies, codes and directives mentioned in clause 9.3 to defense attaches has not been addressed sufficiently. It is submitted that any disciplinary codes, policies or directives should not be applicable to defense attaches, and they are already subject to the criminal jurisdiction of the military courts under their own, the Military Disciplinary Supplementary Act, as I have articulated earlier on. In the light of our submission in the previous paragraph, the applicability issue dealt with in clause 9.4 must be revisited. We further say on the issues of delegation of powers, it is intended that the DERCO DG should empower to delegate any power or duty to a defense attaché, as well as that is the current scope of clause 10.2. Recognition that he may delegate certain powers to some within the mission, humbly the Department of Defense felt that he should also be empowered to delegate any of such power or duty to a defense attaché, as well as that is the current scope of the Act 10.2. Para 11 on offences, it is not necessary that the defense attaché may be included in the scope of Clause 11.1. When members of the Foreign Service are mentioned, as the aspect that Clause 11.1 attempts to address are already addressed in the military disciplinary system that exists for defense attaché by virtue of their appointment in terms of the Defense Act. The military-related legislation is even wide enough to encompass the Foreign Service Bill once promulgated. As the term person, what we seek to say on this one, on the once promulgated, is we've been ahead of ourselves in the review of our own legislation to encompass that gap. As the term person is wide open to include both a member of the Foreign Service and employees of DERCO, the terms member and employee could have been omitted from clause 11.2. Chair, coming to the regulations, our para 12, as the Department of Defense, we humbly note that clause 12.1A does not make the unique conditions of service or disciplinary regime of defense attachés into account. It may indeed be desirable that defense attachés be subject to additional conditions of service, constitute a separate category of foreign service members, that they receive appropriate allowances in line with other members of the Foreign Service. But the intermingling of unique aspects with common aspects for the purpose of defense attachés must be properly considered. The issue of whether defense attachés will be subject to the Foreign Service dispensation could at least be addressed in this regulation as well. Clause 12.1 of the regulation, 12.1D, we note that that clause does not acknowledge the fact that the security requirement for defense attachés forming part of the Foreign Service is not regulated by the Minister of State Security, but by Defense Intelligence. This is enshrined into the national legislation, the National Strategic Intelligence Act, read with the General Intelligence Laws Amendment Act of 2013. It's also captured properly in our Defense Act. It would be advisable for this exception to be mentioned thereof. The clarity of this is we screen, we provide security vetting for the members for the defense attaché. We further provide countermeasures in embassies to protect the defense attachés against foreign intelligence services. But we also note that the Department of Defense chair, the JIC, which is responsible for looking at risk at the embassies and be able to ensure that evacuation orders are in place for all the South African embassies. That recognition thereof, of the role of the Minister of Defense and military veterans on the issue with respect to security, we therefore highlight. Lastly, Chair, 12.1F relates to secondment of employees to the service of a foreign state or international organization. As defense attachés are not included in the definition of employees, it means that the regulations to be promulgated under clause 12.1F will not be applicable to them. However, it is the intention of the clause 12.1F will not be applicable. However, it is the intention of the drafters to exclude the defense attachés in the wider sense of military personnel that are seconded. Should defense attachés not also be, the question we then ask that, should defense attachés not also be subject to such regulations? Notwithstanding the comments made above, the main concern thereof remains the absence of a clear and workable regime to manage defense attaché, and this aspect coupled to the disciplinary aspect, areas that deal with allowances and remunerations, and the command and control regimes would be worth considering in the Foreign Services Bill. Chair, to conclude, we as the Department of Defense and Military Veteran, clearly we want to restate our total commitment to the understanding that we understand our clear-cut role on foreign policy, and understanding that foreign policy to us is the sum total activities sovereign state continue to seek adjustment of its interest with other states. But with diplomacy, ours is in this bill, we ought to see the coming together, the marshalling of all national power potential, one of the national power potential being the military instrument, as to bear for the maximum effect in attaining our national interest. I think with those few words, this is how us as the Department of Defense express ourselves on the bill. I thank you so much.
Just an addition also from my colleague. Perhaps I didn't mention this. I think for protocol reasons, I was supposed to mention that my colleague is the Director of Defense Foreign Relations.
Thank you.
Rato?
Thank you very much, Chair. I will not repeat what my colleague has said. However, there are just 2 points that I would like to emphasize, which I think are critically important. On clause 6 that deals with the Diplomatic Academy, we concur with the aspect related to proper training of our diplomats, even if they're military. And I must also indicate that part of our training does, to some extent, recognize the role that is played by DELCO in preparing our diplomats to also be on par with the provisions and regulations that must be adhered to in terms of the
diplomatic relations. And part of our training also talks to... Part of our training also talks to certain aspects that are provided in terms of training by DELCO. So all we need to do is to really match and incorporate areas that are of common interest. And we do take cognizance of the fact that DELCO does play a very critical role in as far as the preparation of our diplomats as well, being military people. And part of that training, it talks to the protocol aspects as well as the other diplomatic-related training that is provided by DELCO in the courses that we provide in preparation of our defense attaches. The second one talks to Clause 8. Chair, I must emphasize that in the last couple of years, in terms of the audit process, we have been found wanting as a department in as far as accounting for assets that are in foreign missions. You would also be aware that part of what we also do in terms of the peace missions talks to, you know, huge assets that are at our disposal. For instance, in countries like the DRC currently, where we have the peacekeeping missions. But just to talk to the issue now at hand, the assets that are in the missions have posed a very serious problem to the department. We are unable to accurately account for those assets, and that has resulted in certain audit queries that dates back to many years now, where the AG would say, would want to audit your assets. But if you look at the provisions in terms of the standards in DELCO, those assets belong to DELCO, although they are acquired through funding provided by the department. Those are grey areas that we've been trying to address in the last couple of years with DELCO to say we need to synchronize how we conduct, or rather where issues that talk to assets or acquisition of assets, properties, and other related aspects. Our view here is that it is an aspect that cannot be dealt with in a manner in which it has been articulated in the bill. It does not comprehensively address the challenge at hand. We may not be the only department affected. I take cognizance of that fact. There has been extensive consultation in the last year, together with SSA, DHA, the police, trade and industry, as well as DELCO, to say how best can we align ourselves on issues of commonality, but make sure that we retain our mandate. I do not want to use the word independence. We retain our mandate in areas where operationally we may have to exercise certain uniqueness as the military. I think my colleague talked about the issue of the JIG, which is very critical to us. We may not be necessarily exposed to areas that talk to how best can we evacuate our South Africans in a particular mission where a need may arise. But those are aspects that may not necessarily be addressed in an open meeting in a mission to say how best can we employ, for instance, the special forces to evacuate South Africans in a mission. So there are areas that may require extensive deliberation beyond or before this bill can be promulgated. Collectively with DELCO, but as well as with the involvement of other departments. I just want to highlight that point, that we are currently sitting with other areas that may require, you know, legislative consideration with respective departments. We have already started doing that as a department. We are engaging DEVCO in areas where we find ourselves not in a position to adequately and properly comply, for instance, with the PFMA, where issues of assets or accountability of assets is concerned. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Now I want to invite hands for comments from the honourable members. Honourable Mpumlwana. Maila. Molefe. Baputi. Katera. Sometimes we are Ratebe, eh? Mpumlwana. Babu Mpumlwana.
Yeah. General, I appreciate your...
Sorry, what's wrong with our... Sorry, Honorable Mpumla.
General, you have done a good job. There's only one thing that, why is this military man running away now? How do I? He was good to assist us now. No, don't run away, Dadu. Very good, General. I noted some of the things, and I the only thing that I would like you, it's good that you didn't bring the presentation because once more. I always believe that people put a positive contribution because you know more than I do, actually, that what are the problems in controlling personnel in the foreign area. Secondly, you know the secrets and the sensitivity of the things of that associated with the defense more than I do. Now, you are coming here and you are saying these are the problems. I would be happy to say that would be an ideal solution. Because the problem that we have in general here is that we've got DECO and so many other things. We've got agriculture, you've got this, you've got, you know, we've got so many people that are being controlled by their various acts at home. And they have got their own assets there. And the person who is there and becomes an opposite general who is the head of the mission. He's going to say, hey, do this, and say, wait a minute, I'm controlled in Pretoria, not you. And so on. And coming to the various clauses, the question of employees, I think you need to determine and come with a suggestion. What, how do you want us to move? Do you want to be a separate entity within DECO? Or you make some arrangement and just become employees of DECO as far as people are concerned, outside, except of course when you are like a DRC or you are on a certain mission. But don't you think that if you just stand there as a member of the of DECO, who knows that you are in Bogoto there. Nobody has to know that you are in Bogoto. You can be an employee of DECO and be directly under it, but you've got an indirect connection. I don't know how you can put it, but decide on that. Secondly, on the question of the PFMA, if you have, if we need, because we are making laws here, PFMA is also our law,
if there is a need that you think that the PFMA has to be changed here and there to accommodate whatever, please come up with a suggestion. This, because this thing basically revolves around trade. Question of recall. It is the diplomat that is being called by a foreign government. Hey, Bumlan has done some, I'm sure Bumlan won't do it. Bumlan has done something wrong in this particular country and he has to leave tomorrow. If the diplomat has no authority, he's not being called, a defense DG in South Africa. He's been the person who is on the ground now representing the president and the country of the people of South Africa. He's the diplomat. Now, if he cannot give instructions that many go home when, even if this is done in, you know, working together with the South African and say, hey, your man has to be recalled, that type of a thing. But he has to be involved in that. He cannot be, it cannot be that it's something that comes from, and then you can discipline him when you get there. But all I'm asking to assist us when we're making this bill is to please come with positive contribution and say, this is what we would like. Then, when we look at all your contributions at the end of the day, we then can synchronize, we can just put them together and see what can be good. And thirdly, and lastly, I would like you to tell me, what is the position presently in South Africa and with your experience in as far as other countries are concerned? I know that America is some kind of independent completely. They are just there as if. Now, so what is the position with other countries? And presently, what is the position now? And what are the problems, if any, caused by the present position? Thank you.
Honorable Maila.
What's the title again? Brigadier General. Okay. Okay, thanks, Brigadier General, for the presentation. Like what Honorable Mpumlan is saying, well, I did not hear you saying the bill is not fine with you. I hear you supporting that the bill is a step in the right direction. But now, I heard you pointing in several areas where especially military attaches are not covered. My proposal would be, instead of just saying they are not covered, that maybe we come up with a suggestion that maybe this is how they could be covered. And then we'll take it from there. There is the issue of Clause 4 on the head of mission. The bill seeks to project the head of mission as being responsible for management and administration of all members of the foreign service in a particular mission. And I hear you to be saying there are some gaps there. In the light of the Department of Defense, what could be the best model on how especially military attaches could be reporting? And lastly, Chair, on the issue of assets, I think Brigadier General also indicated their frustration on the issue of assets, which is something that we also have frustration on as DERCO. Now, I wanted to check, in terms of audit purposes, how does the Office of the Auditor General interact with the Department of Defense? I don't know how to put it. Do the Auditor General, do they go to several areas where you have personnel to go and conduct audit, or do they audit you just here at head office? How does it work about? I heard you were saying that there are discussions between the department and DERCO. Maybe with time you will be able to tell us how far those have gone. Thanks, Chairperson. Those were my contributions.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Maila. Honorable Molefe.
Chair. Having had the privilege of serving the Republic under the Public Service Act as well as under the Defense Act, I can confirm that the two acts are chalk and cheese.
The two acts are?
Chalk and cheese. They're not the same.
Chalk and cheese.
Yeah. Because the Defense Act is very different from the Public Service Act. And in fact, I do not see how attachés or the Defense Force will be able to retain their discipline that they require from the attachés in the same way that the Department of International Relations keeps discipline over their people. For example, in the Defense Force, a left hand is a left hand. And there's no correspondence, there's no... In the Public Service Act, you can ask your union representative whether it should be a left hand or what, and so on. But in the defense, it's a left hand, especially when it comes from general. On reading the bill, my initial feeling was that perhaps there should be a section that deals with defense personnel, and that the defense personnel is excluded from the general applicability of this bill, and that there be a section that just deals with defense personnel that is aligned with the Defense Act, with the Code of Conduct, with Act 16 of 1999, and that also deals with multilateral deployments, as well as the rules of the department with respect to defense attachés, which rules do not apply to the general employees in the civil service. So I felt that maybe there should be a section just dealing with defense. But on listening to the general, I actually think that maybe we need a bill like this one, because it is actually very extensive. A bill like this one that is submitted simultaneously with this one that deals with defense personnel. But the advantage of doing it together and getting international relations and defense to work together on the matter is that they will eliminate areas of contradictions if they are done at about the same time. So that there is a basic decorum and discipline that is afforded by the attaché to the ambassador. But also there is also an understanding that the defense attaché is not the same as your home affairs employee at the embassy. So perhaps my suggestion would be that maybe we should consider drafting another bill that deals with defense. On training, I agree that the Defense Force has its own training for attachés, and they do not go to the Foreign Service Diplomatic School. But perhaps in this bill we should say that as an extra measure, attachés must also go to the Foreign Service School, just to make sure that they understand, because there could be big misunderstandings as a result of the training doctrine in the defense attaché training as well as in our normal diplomatic school, so that the defense attaché can understand the people that they have to work with in the embassies. That would be the only area or substance where I think that maybe that is where we should consider aligning by getting defense attachés to also attend over and above their training at the Defense Force, to attend the civilian training. But I actually think that these things are so different that that we need another bill. For example, the whole area of what the general referred to as a deployment multilateral organizations like the UN as military personnel. This is not even covered here. Peacekeeping missions, command and control under peacekeeping missions, who's responsible for what, these are not even covered here. But maybe we should get a more substantive bill dealing with foreign service in the defense force. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Lefe. Honorable Rapoti.
Yeah, I think somehow in that day, Molefe have tried to unpack some uncertainties, you know, because these people are in the defense. I was just asking myself, what is the role of a defense attaché on a day-to-day basis outside the country? You know, when you were just saying, and especially on the issue of the condition of service, because I can see that, as you said, that the they've got their own military disciplinary code. So if ever this person perform a misconduct, what is it going to do about you? And I was also asking myself that the assets, which unique assets are there in the mission, especially on the defense side? What kind of assets? Because I can understand with other, like the DTI and that, probably we've got common ones, but the unique ones from the defense side, what do we have? If they can just tell us, you know, we just want to know clarity in that. On the diplomatic training, this person is a soldier outside the country, and I think on the diplomatic training, he's also part of the diplomat. Do we call him a diplomat or a soldier? So those are the things that I really wanted to know. Or attaché. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Khatebe. Thank you, pleasure, ma'am. My other meeting actually started at 12. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all,
I'd like to appreciate the presentation, although with these shortcomings we said that it is not here in front of us. But first of all, I appreciate the fact that the issue of the Diplomatic Academy of IR is being acknowledged that it is necessary in moving forward. Why, Chair, I raise that is because once a person, even if it's a soldier or an attaché, once on his uniform, or in her uniform, there's a flag of South Africa. Everyone who's going to come across that person will associate whatever he does or she does with South Africa. I'll make an example. Last year in the EU Parliament, I raised a serious issue. One peacekeeping force from the EU made, actually attacked those people who were supposed to protect. Take for example, they went to an extent doing something despicable. Forcing the children of that country to have to conduct bestiality with the animals, with their dogs. Yeah. So whatever you say, the country where those soldiers are coming from, their reputation is in tatters. Yeah. Because we had to raise sharply. I'm very happy that when the side of the National Defense appreciate that they are certain, if apart from the military discipline, there's brand South Africa, which must be protected. I'm happy with that aspect, that we acknowledge that, we go forward. But on the issue, Chair, of the head of mission itself, even here, the president might not be a military man. Very fortunately, the current one was a military man. But the head of mission becomes the political head of that mission. The military must account to the political head. So I think on that polar regard, there must be no two ways about that. At the end of the day,
the overall responsibility in the mission must be the head of mission, because he or she represents the president of the country. I think there must be no two ways about that. But what can help us, Chair, is that this Defence Force Act, I think that it must be brought before us here, so that we are taken through it, so that we understand the dynamics which are involved. I can make an example then. When coming to the issue of accountability of the property, there's PFMA, there's the Auditor General's Office. As they are lamenting about the issue of accountability of the assets, did they interact with the Office of the Auditor General so that those issues or those frustrations are raised with that, so that if necessary, that clause which deals with assets here can be strengthened so that it can accommodate their unique situation? I can make an example. There are certain military equipment which were left in the Central African Republic, The heart was bleeding when you see that this is our vehicle, that one. It was left behind. The issue, how was it accounted for? Because it was acquired through the public funds of South Africa. So that's why the issue of the Defence Act really must be also be brought in our attention so that we deal with it. So it means that I'm basically aligning myself with the Honourable Minister, but we cannot, because the Defence Force was not prepared to whatever review is, it cannot hold this process hostage. But I think that before we finalise this one, we must be taken through on the implication of the Defence Force Act, on the application of this Act, because then we can make informed decisions out of that. By the last Chair, I really appreciate the input. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I then make my last comment and close on the matter in the absence of other members? I will only make two, which is that first let me join my colleagues that you do need a memorandum with regard to certain aspects of the work of the Department of Defense and DERCO to understand each other as to how you're going to interact with regard to certain matters. And I want to bring a matter that's not quite controversial, but it is a matter of military stroke national interest, for instance. I take it that at a particular time, a department like defense, even state security, should not disclose certain information or certain assets or a nature of particular assets at the time that it is involved in an operation, whether it's an offensive mission or it's a peacekeeping mission. Because, okay, of course, the Auditor General will say, what is there? But can we tell him that, we've planted so many landmines? I mean, there are things that you may not disclose at a particular time to an institution like that. Now, I don't know whether at some time, because South African money has been used for those things, then it can be done. But I just take it that under certain conditions you may not disclose information like that. And soldiers, that's the second one, on offenses, like Molefe was saying, it's chalk and cheese. Soldiers the world over don't want to be subjected to the command sometimes, or sometimes the discipline, or sometimes the instruction or command of a civilian. You see, Nina Umuntu Wenza, we are misconductor, Niam court martial. Now, this time we will constitute a disciplinary committee, like busy the social lane. They may not want to be subjected to things like that. So the memorandum of understanding must clarify itself that the head of mission, for instance, can complain and then direct the head of department in defense to court martial, recommend that certain things should happen, something like that. I thought those were the two things, but generally, I think you have heard us, and it is that you need an engagement with the department yet they are gone on the very things that you have said, and then don't remember that tomorrow Sifuna the document and present it to the members. But on the general comments that have been made, can we hear you?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, we will start with the general principles. First, we recognize ourselves as the military expression of the people of South Africa, who are yourselves. Secondly, we also understand that we are the intercourse of politics. We are the tool of politics. We are not a standalone. In a constitutional democracy, moreover, there are two things which we note that underpins us. First is the professional conduct of us entails two aspects. The first aspect is the normative principles that underpins us. The subordination of ourselves to the constitutional order, to the political authority, the total accountability of us as military. At a functional level, the expectation from yourself that I'm fit, I'm proper, I look like a person who provide confidence that we will defend the country. It's something I wanted to address that from where we are sitting, in terms of our code of conduct, we embody the constitutional principles of the country. So there's no two ways about us in terms of civil control, whether we're in missions. The other aspect I wanted to briefly touch base on is who we are. We are just the basic concept of defense diplomacy is diplomacy conducted by men in uniform, men and women in uniform, or otherwise civilians in the defense ministries. There's clarity on us about where do we find space and expression to do this. So we further say we are the element or the component of foreign policy that aims to bring greater transparency, confidence in military spheres, and contribution towards closer relations with others, with other countries, through constructive defense resources in pursuit of our national objectives in peace and wartime. That defines the trust lines in us. Maybe it's also important that we further express ourselves that we understand diplomacy and force not necessarily as opposing ends in the spectrum of national policy. We seamlessly support each other. We are there to ensure the foreign policy objectives of our country are attained through the military instrument. That's the clarity with ourselves. We therefore want to express here that at a very strategic level, military or defense diplomacy, one can say it is the use of defense by the state to advance diplomacy and engagement in bilateral, multilateral, including security arrangements. Therefore, we are the essential constituents of international diplomacy, an essential element fostering bilateral regional relationship conducted to further political ends. That's us. Now, if I would take you now to the Department of Defense strategic objective, one of it, it says we must ensure regional security. That angle also comes, that diplomatic angle also comes. Lastly, to just overall, there's a political or political-military spectrum of defense. First, underpinning three things. The foreign policy role of armed forces. Armed forces have got the foreign policy role. We also represent a transition from military to political domain because there are dimensions of diplomacy that we must serve. We serve the political instrument. That relates, we've got the military industry. We need to articulate and advance the cause of economic opportunities that are harbored in this country in furtherance of our military industry. Now, conceptually, to just sum up this one, is you'll find there's a, it's not a double paradox, but there's a paradoxically, the paradox of defense diplomacy is you then fuse this, your incommensurable extremes, violent coercion, because military is synonymous, not the military that served the people's cause. The Imperial Army served violence. We serve the political ends, why? Because why? The People's Army. That's the definitive role of us as SANDF. We therefore, coming to the question, we wanted to just clearly clarify that role, that we humbly and very eager to really be aligned. Noted from Honorable Ubabu.
Yes.
Yes. In terms of assets, I think the general has also expressed that there's a role to account, but summed up by also Honorable Mr. Mulefa to say we ought to look at the issues of accountability. Our Minister of Defense comes to Parliament, he accounts about assets acquired through funding which is given to the Department of Defense. We made a submission to say let's find each other with DERCO on that one. And we further also recognize the fact that the Diplomatic Academy, we need to express also our cause is not unique militarily. It's been addressed by consumer diplomats from the school. We also present at the school because we are a state. We are together with this. Now, with the two laws that seem not to be giving expression to each other, your Public Service Act, we advance two motions. One motion is to say, DERCO notes the PFMA, it doesn't address us, it puts us outside the bracket of what you term as foreign service. But we also say, noting further that we also operate in multilateral institution, note the issues of secondment, which are current practice that are there. Therefore, these are inputs which we are making towards this bill, which we were reading. And the clause 4, in terms of the head of a mission, we're quite open and clear about the political intercourse which military is subordinated to it. However, we say a defense attaché has got a conflict of interest. He advances the Department of Defense strategic objective, ensure regional security. He further enhances the foreign policy objectives. He therefore has got two bosses, and that recognition ought to be expressly retained. Indeed, a defense attaché reports to the head of a mission. He has also a role to report to the Minister of Defense through the chief. If he's not doing that, one of the tasks you've given to military is to ensure military intelligence. And that input from the defense attaché that got evaluated and analyzed the defense intelligence, it also work on those things. And there's a clear recognition onto those aspects. Chairman Bagot, I'm sure you may be able to add on.
Maybe just to add on the issue of the question of the head of the mission. I think there has been clarity provided. Administratively, the head of the mission takes responsibility for the conduct of the defense attaché. Operationally, we take responsibility for how the defense attaché conducts his or her activities within the mission as prescribed in the rules and the policies of the Department of Defense. Maybe lastly, Chair, in the interest of time, there is an existing memorandum of understanding between ourselves and DERCO, which is currently applicable, where issues of accountability of assets and the audit processes are addressed. However, the issue here of interest is how, therefore, do we ensure that the accountability finds resonance with the Auditor General? Because when we are audited as an independent department. Those are the issues that I said needs to be addressed through the provisions of the TFME, just to look at how missions are managed, as well as, you know, in a way find expression in the TFME, so that we are not found wanting when issues of accountability are expected from various departments in the mission. Perhaps lastly, from my part, Chair, one would agree with what Honorable Molefe has said in relation to how we then make sure that there is sync between all the acts and there is no contradiction in as far as the issues of, you know, overlapping responsibilities that one act would prescribe and the other one would want to then oppose. And I must indicate that in as far as issues of command and control have been alluded to, we have had instances where defense attaches, because of their conduct, would be reported to Defense Intelligence, which is responsible for the defense attaches, and appropriate action has been taken accordingly. We give due recognition to the head of mission in the interest of a one mission concept in support to South African national objectives and interests. That to us is very central and very critical. They are not there autonomous and conducting operations in isolation with what is prescribed in law in South Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and of course do express our gratitude to the Director General and the Minister for the assignment that they have given to you. At the end, I will write letters to all the ministers when I indicate that they must lastly just make inputs on the drafts that would have sent to them, to thank them for the input. Because as we always say, the bill ultimately will become the property of South Africa, even if it comes from any other department. Bampumlan, on
that,
this one.
That, no, just to be honest, I was going to say that what you are expected to do tomorrow, I think it's just what you said. But what I was requesting, I need you to go back and sit down and count the positive opinion.
On item number 3, you are ready. On item number 3, honourable members, this should take us just 1 or 2 minutes. And it is that in various State of the Nation addresses in Parliament by the President, you can check 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, and even 2017, President indicated that South Africa pledges solidarity with countries like Palestine, like Cuba, and Western Sahara. Now, in this instance, Western Sahara is still regarded as the only colonized country within the African continent. And accordingly, the portfolio committee, together with the deputy minister, that is Derko, is organizing a public lecture on Western Sahara next week, Wednesday. And now, regarding the preparations and the logistics, I want to Mr. Lubabalo, Mr. Sikwela, I'm sorry, to speak to that. And of course, the members must be duly invited, and all the stakeholders that will be coming there. What is the state of preparation? Maybe so that I don't come back. Yesterday I was talking to Honorable Frolic. There was just one issue that he was raising, and we've attended to that issue, and he has granted approval. Next week, Wednesday. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. The seminar will happen at E249, and the starting time is 9 for 10 o'clock in the morning. And Chair, we, as you just mentioned now, we have been granted all approvals to host the event, and invitations have been sent to organizations by DECO, and now what is left that we invite our own members of parliament and other committees which are relevant to the topic. Thank you, Chair.
Any other thing?
No other logistics, no? Yes. But send them the program, because I see that in the program there are people who are going to give vote of thanks, and one of them is actually in the NCOP, and he was not cited about the program and the responsibility and the concept paper itself. Honorable Makua, and I gave him my concept paper, so I need a new one. Give it to the members. There are those who are going to be panelists, so they must prepare themselves. All of those loose ends must be tied. With that, honorable members, I think we should... any questions or comments on this one? There are none. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Lunch is served.
Oh, lunch is served, honorable members. Abafuna ukunona. Ora balambile.
Nona.
No, Mukhalapa is going to the same meeting that I'm going to.
Thank you.
from the walls, though.
I was in a barber shop.
Well, that's what they are changing. Oh, no. Come on. So, obviously, that's controversial.
Now, where did I find it out?
Yes. Let's go.
Ah!